siblings. You'll know the sort of thing.
I expect so, I said. Then it was you and the good liquor that was arriving at 10. Madame Jeanne said...
Aye, he said, frowning.
She was meant to have the cellar door open and the ramp in place at 10 sharp. We haven't got long to get everything unloaded. She was bloody late this morning. I had to circle round twice to keep from bringing the dragoon straight to the door.
She was a bit distracted, I said, remembering suddenly about the fiend. I told Jamie about the murder at the Green Owl, and he grimaced, crossing himself.
Poor lass, he said.
I shuddered briefly at the memory of Bruno's description and moved closer to Jamie, who put an arm about my shoulders. He kissed me absently on the forehead, glancing again at the shawl-covered shape on the ground.
Well, whoever he was, if he wasn't an exciseman, there are likely no more of them upstairs. We should be able to get out of here soon.
That's good. Jamie's coat covered me to the knees, but I felt the covert glances cast from the far end of the room at my bare calves, and was all too uncomfortably aware that I was naked under it. Will we be going back to the print shop? What with one thing and another, I didn't think I wanted to take advantage of Madame Jeanne's hospitality any longer than necessary.
Maybe for a bit. I'll have to think.
Jamie's tone was abstracted, and I could see that his brow was furrowed in thought. With a brief hug, he released me and began to walk about the cellar, staring meditatively at the stones underfoot. What did you do with Ian? He glanced up, looking blank. Then his face cleared.
Oh, Ian. I left him making inquiries at the taverns above the market cross.
I'll need to remember to meet him later, he muttered, as though making a note to himself.
I met young Ian, by the way, I said conversationally.
Jamie looked startled.
He came here?
He did, looking for you, about a quarter of an hour after you left, in fact.
Thank God for small mercies.
He rubbed a hand through his hair, looking simultaneously amused and worried.
I'd have had the devil of a time explaining to Ian what his son was doing here.
You know what he was doing here? I asked curiously.
No, I don't. He was supposed to be... Ah, well, let it be. I cannot be worried about it just now.
He relapsed into thought, emerging momentarily to ask,
Did young Ian see where he was going when he left you?
I shook my head, gathering the coat around myself, and he nodded, sighed, and took up his slow pacing once more. I sat down on an upturned tub and watched him. In spite of the general atmosphere of discomfort and danger, I felt absurdly happy simply to be near him. Feeling that there was little I could do to help the situation at present, I settled myself with the coat wrapped around me and abandoned myself to the momentary pleasure of looking at him, something I had had no chance to do in the tumult of events. In spite of his preoccupation, he moved with the sure-footed grace of a swordsman, a man so aware of his body as to be able to forget it entirely. The men by the casks worked by the torchlight. It gleamed on his hair as he turned, lighting it like a tiger's fur with stripes of gold and dark. I caught the faint twitch as two fingers of his right hand flickered together against the fabric of his breeches, and felt a strange little lurch of recognition in the gesture. I had seen him do that 1,000 times as he was thinking, and seeing it now again, felt as though all the time that had passed in our separation was no more than the rising and setting of a single sun. As though catching my thought, he paused in his strolling and smiled at me.
"You'll be warm enough, Sassenach," he asked.
"No, but it doesn't matter."
I got off my tub and went to join him in his peregrinations, slipping a hand through his arm.
"Making any progress with the thinking?"
He laughed ruefully.
"No, I'm thinking of maybe 6 things together, and 6 of them things I cannot do anything about. Like whether young Ian's where he should be."
I stared up at him. Where he should be? Where do you think he should be?
He should be at the print shop, Jamie said with some emphasis. But he should have been with Wally this morning, and he wasn't.
With Wally? You mean you knew he wasn't at home when his father came looking for him this morning? He rubbed his nose with a finger, looking at once irritated and amused.
Why? I promised young Ian I wouldn't say anything to his da, though, until he'd had a chance to explain himself. Not that an explanation is likely to save his ass, he added.
Young Ian had, as his father said, come to join his uncle in Edinburgh without the preliminary bother of asking his parents' leave. Jamie had discovered this dereliction fairly quickly, but hadn't wanted to send his nephew alone back to Lollybrock, and hadn't yet had time to escort him personally.
"It's not that he cannot look out for himself," Jamie explained, amusement winning in the struggle of expressions on his face. "He's a nice, capable lad. It's just... well, you ken how things just happen round some folk without them seeming to have anything much to do with it."
"Now that you mention it, yes," I said wryly. "I'm one of them." He laughed out loud at that.
"God, you're right, Sassenach. Maybe that's why I like young Ian so well. He minds me of you."
"He reminded me a bit of you," I said. Jamie snorted briefly.
"God, Jenny will maim me, and she hears her baby son's been loitering about a house of ill repute. I hope the wee bugger has the sense to keep his mouth shut once he's home."
"I hope he gets home," I said, thinking of the gawky, almost 15-year-old I had seen that morning, adrift in an Edinburgh filled with prostitutes, excisemen, smugglers, and hatchet-wielding fiends. "At least he isn't a girl," I added, thinking of this last item. "The fiend doesn't seem to have a taste for young boys."
"Aye, well, there are plenty of others who have," Jamie said sourly. "Between young Ian and you, Sassenach, I should be lucky if my hair's not gone white by the time we get out of the stinking cellar."
"Me?" I said in surprise. "You don't need to worry about me."
"I don't."
He dropped my arm and rounded on me, glaring.
"I dinna need to worry about you. Is that what you said? Christ! I'll leave you safely in bed waiting for your breakfast. And not an hour later, I find you downstairs in your shift, clutching a corpse to your bosom. And now you're standing in front of me, bare as an egg, with 15 men over there wondering who in hell you are. And how do you think I'm going to explain you to them, Sassenach? Tell me that, eh?"
He shoved a hand through his hair in exasperation.
"Sweet bleeding Jesus! And I've got to go up the coast in 2 days without fail. But I cannot leave you in Edinburgh, not with fiends creeping about with hatchets, and half the people who've seen you thinking you're a prostitute, and...
The lacing round his pigtail broke abruptly under the pressure, and his hair fluffed out round his head like a lion's mane. I laughed. He glared for a moment longer, but then a reluctant grin made its way slowly through the frown.
"I will," he said, resigned. "I suppose I'll manage."
"I suppose you will," I said, and stood on tiptoe to brush his hair back behind his ears. Working on the same principle that causes magnets of opposing polarities to snap together when placed in close proximity, he bent his head and kissed me.
"I had forgotten," he said a moment later.
"Forgotten what?" His back was warm through the thin shirt.
"Everything."
He spoke very softly, mouth against my hair.
"Joy, fear. Fear, most of all."
His hand came up and smoothed my curls away from his nose.
"I haven't been afraid for a very long time, Sassenach," he whispered. "But now I think I am. For there is something to be lost now."
I drew back a little to look up at him. His arms were locked tight around my waist, his eyes dark as bottomless water in the dimness. Then his face changed and he kissed me quickly on the forehead.
"Come along, Sassenach," he said, taking me by the arm. "I'll tell the men you're my wife. The rest of it will just have to bide."
Chapter 27 Up in Flames. The dress was a trifle lower cut than necessary and a bit tight in the bosom, but on the whole, not a bad fit. "And how did you know Daphne would be the right size?" I asked, spooning up my soup.
"I said I didn't abed with the lassies," Jamie replied circumspectly. "I never said I didn't look at them."
He blinked at me like a large red owl. Some congenital tick made him incapable of closing one eye in a wink, and I laughed.
"That gown becomes ye a good deal more than it did Daphne, though."
He cast a glance of general approval at my bosom and waved at a serving maid carrying a platter of fresh bannocks. Mowbray's tavern was doing a thriving dinner business. Several cuts above the snug, smoky atmosphere to be found in the World's End and similar serious drinking establishments, Mowbray's was a large and elegant place with an outside stair that ran up to the second floor, where a commodious dining room accommodated the appetites of Edinburgh's prosperous tradesmen and public officials. "Who are you at the moment?" I asked. "I heard Madame Jeanne call you Monsieur Fraser. Are you Fraser in public, though?" He shook his head and broke a bannock into his soup bowl.
"No, at the moment I'm Sawney Malcolm, printer and publisher."
"Sawney? That's a nickname for Alexander, is it? I should have thought Sandy was more like it, especially considering your hair." Not that his hair was sandy-coloured in the least, I reflected, looking at it. It was like Bree's hair, very thick, with a slight wave to it, and all the colours of red and gold mixed, copper and cinnamon, auburn and amber, red and roan and rufous, all mingled together. I felt a sudden wave of longing for Bree. At the same time, I longed to untie Jamie's hair from its formal plait and run my hands up under it, to feel the solid curve of his skull and the soft strands tangled in my fingers. I could still recall the tickle of it, spilling loose and rich across my breasts in the morning light. My breath coming a little short, I bent my head to my oyster stew. Jamie appeared not to have noticed. He added a large pat of butter to his bowl, shaking his head as he did so.
"Sawney's what they see in the Highlands," he informed me, "and in the Isles, too. Sandy's more what ye'd hear in the Lowlands, or from an ignorant Sassenach."
He lifted one eyebrow at me, smiling, and raised a spoonful of the rich, fragrant stew to his mouth. "All right," I said. "I suppose more to the point, though. Who am I?" He had noticed, after all. I felt one large foot nudge mine, and he smiled at me over the rim of his cup.
"You're my wife, Sassenach," he said gruffly. "Always. No matter who I may be, you're my wife."
I could feel the flush of pleasure arise in my face and see the memories of the night before reflected in his own. The tips of his ears were faintly pink. "You don't suppose there's too much pepper in this stew?" I asked, swallowing another spoonful. "Are you sure, Jamie?"
"Aye," he said. "I am sure," he amended. "And no, the pepper's fine. I like a wee bit of pepper."
The foot moved slightly against mine, the toe of his shoe barely brushing my ankle. "So, I'm Mrs. Malcolm," I said, trying out the name on my tongue. The mere fact of saying Mrs. gave me an absurd little thrill, like a new bride. Involuntarily, I glanced down at the silver ring on my right fourth finger. Jamie caught the glance and raised his cup to me.
"To Mrs. Malcolm," he said softly,
and the breathless feeling came back. He set down the cup and took my hand. His own was big and so warm that a general feeling of glowing heat spread rapidly through my fingers. I could feel the silver ring separate from my flesh, its metal heated by his touch.
"To have and to hold," he said, smiling.
"From this day forward," I said, not caring in the least that we were attracting interested glances from the other diners. Jamie bent his head and pressed his lips against the back of my hand, an action that turned the interested glances into frank stares. A clergyman was seated across the room. He glared at us and said something to his companions, who turned round to stare. One was a small elderly man. The other, I was surprised to see, was Mr. Wallace, my companion from the Inverness coach.
"There are private rooms upstairs," Jamie murmured, blue eyes dancing over my knuckles, and I lost interest in Mr. Wallace.
"How interesting," I said. "You haven't finished your stew."
"Damn the stew! Here comes a serving maid with the ale. Devil take her!"
Sharp white teeth closed gently on my knuckle, making me jerk slightly in my seat.
"People are watching you." "Let them, and I trust they've a fine day for it."
His tongue flicked gently between my fingers.
"There's a man in a green coat coming this way." "To hell," Jamie began,
when the shadow of the visitor fell upon the table.
"A good day to you, Mr. Malcolm," said the visitor, bowing politely. "I trust I do not intrude."
"You do,"
said Jamie, straightening up, but keeping his grip on my hand. He turned a cool gaze on the newcomer.
"I think I do not know you, sir."
The gentleman, an Englishman of maybe 35, quietly dressed, bowed again, not intimidated by this marked lack of hospitality.
"I have not had the pleasure of your acquaintance as yet, sir," he said deferentially. "My master, however, bade me greet you and inquire whether you and your companion might be so agreeable as to take a little wine with him."
The tiny pause before the word companion was barely discernible, but Jamie caught it. His eyes narrowed.
"My wife and I," he said, with precisely the same sort of pause before wife, "are otherwise engaged at the moment. Should your master wish to speak, Weimer?" "It is Sir Percival Turner who sends to ask, sir,"
the secretary, for so he must be, put in quickly. Well-bred as he was, he couldn't resist a tiny flick of one eyebrow as one who uses a name he expects to conjure with.
"Indeed," said Jamie dryly. "Well, with all respect to Sir Percival, I am preoccupied at present. If you will convey him my regrets."
He bowed with a politeness so pointed as to come within a hair of rudeness, and turned his back on the secretary. That gentleman stood for a moment, his mouth slightly open, then pivoted smartly on his heel and made his way through the scatter of tables to a door on the far side of the dining room.
"Where was I?" Jamie demanded. "Oh, aye, to hell we gentlemen in green coats."
"No,
about these private rooms."
"How are you going to explain me to people?" I asked. He raised one eyebrow.
"Explain what?"
He looked me up and down.
"Why must I make excuses for you? You're no missing any limbs. You're not poxed, hunchbacked, toothless or lame." "You know what I mean," I said, kicking him lightly under the table.
The lady sitting near the wall nudged her companion and widened her eyes disapprovingly at us. I smiled nonchalantly at them.
"Aye, I do," he said, grinning. "However, what with Mr. Willoughby's activities this morning and one thing and another, I haven't had much chance to think about the matter. Perhaps I'll just say..." "My dear fellow, so you are married. Capital news, simply capital. My deepest congratulations, and may I be, dare I hope to be, the first to extend my felicitations and best wishes to your lady."
A small elderly gentleman in a tidy wig leaned heavily on a gold-knobbed stick, beaming genially at us both. It was the little gentleman who had been sitting with Mr. Wallace and the clergyman.
"You will pardon the minor discourtesy of my sending Johnson to fetch you earlier, I'm sure," he said deprecatingly. "It is only that my wretched infirmity prevents rapid movement, as you see."
Jamie had risen to his feet at the appearance of the visitor, and with a polite gesture now drew out a chair.
"You'll join us, Sir Percival," he said. "Oh, no, no, indeed. Shouldn't dream of intruding on your new happiness, my dear sir. Truly, I had no idea."
Still protesting gracefully, he sank down into the proffered chair, wincing as he extended his foot beneath the table.
"I am a martyr to gout, my dear," he confided, leaning close enough for me to smell his foul old man's breath beneath the wintergreen that spiced his linen. He didn't look corrupt, I thought, breath notwithstanding. But then, appearances could be deceiving. It was only about 4 hours since I'd been mistaken for a prostitute.
Making the best of it, Jamie called for wine and accepted Sir Percival's continued effusions with some grace.
"It is rather fortunate that I should have encountered you here, my dear fellow," the elderly gentleman said, breaking off his flowery compliments at last.
He laid a small manicured hand on Jamie's sleeve.
"I had something particular to say to you. In fact, I had sent a note to the print shop, but my messenger failed to find you there."
"Ah?" Jamie cocked an eyebrow in question.
"Yes," Sir Percival went on. "I believe you had spoken to me some weeks ago, I scarce recall the occasion, of your intention to travel north on business. A matter of a new press, or something of the sort?"
Sir Percival had quite a sweet face, I thought, handsomely patrician despite his years, with large, guileless blue eyes.
"Aye, that's so," Jamie agreed courteously. "I am invited by Mr. MacLeod of Perth to see a new style of letterpress he's recently put in use."
"Quite." Sir Percival paused to remove a snuff-box from his pocket, a pretty thing, enamelled in green and gold, with cherubs on the lid.
"I really should not advise a trip to the north just now," he said, opening the box and concentrating on its contents. "Really, I should not. The weather is likely to be inclement at this season. I'm sure it would not suit Mrs. Malcolm."
Smiling at me like an elderly angel, he inhaled a large pinch of snuff and paused, linen handkerchief at the ready. Jamie sipped at his wine, his face blandly composed.
"I'm grateful for your advice, Sir Percival," he said. "You'll perhaps have received word from your agents of recent storms to the north."
Sir Percival sneezed, a small neat sound, like a mouse with a cold. He was rather like a white mouse altogether, I thought, seeing him dab daintily at his pointed pink nose.
"Quite," he said again,
putting away the kerchief and blinking benevolently at Jamie.
"No, I would, as a particular friend with your welfare at heart, most strongly advise that you remain in Edinburgh. After all," he added, turning the beam of his benevolence on me, "you surely have an inducement to remain comfortably at home now, do you not? And now, my dear young people, I am afraid I must take my leave. I must not detain you any longer from what must be your wedding breakfast."
With a little assistance from the hovering Johnson, Sir Percival got up and tottered off, his gold-knobbed stick tap-tapping on the floor.
"He seems a nice old gent," I remarked, when I was sure he was far enough away not to hear me.
Jamie snorted.
"Rotten as a worm-riddled board," he said.
He picked up his glass and drained it.
"You'd think otherwise," he said meditatively,
putting it down and staring after the wizened figure now cautiously negotiating the head of the stairs.
"A man as close as Sir Percival is to judgment, do you mean? You'd think fear of the devil would prevent him, but not a bit." "I suppose he's like everyone else," I said cynically. "Most people think they're going to live forever."
Jamie laughed, his exuberant spirits returning with a rush.
"Aye, that's true," he said.
He pushed my wine glass toward me.
"And now you're here, Sassenach. I'm convinced of it. Drink up, Moneen Down, and we'll go upstairs."
Post coitum omni animalium triste est, I remarked, with my eyes closed. There was no response from the warm, heavy weight on my chest, save the gentle sigh of his breathing. After a moment, though, I felt a sort of subterranean vibration which I interpreted as amusement.
"That's a very peculiar sentiment, Sassenach," Jamie said,
his voice blurred with drowsiness.
Not your own, I hope.
No.
I stroked the damp, bright hair back from his forehead, and he turned his face into the curve of my shoulder with a small, contented snuffle. The private rooms at Mowbray's left a bit to be desired in the way of amorous accommodation. Still, the sofa at least offered a padded horizontal surface, which, if you came right down to it, was all that was necessary. While I had decided that I wasn't past wanting to commit passionate acts after all, I was still too old to want to commit them on the bare floorboards.
I don't know who said it, some ancient philosopher or other. It was quoted in one of my medical textbooks, in the chapter on the human reproductive system.
The vibration made itself audible as a small chuckle.
You seem to have applied yourself to your lessons to good purpose, Sassenach, he said.
His hand passed down my side and wormed its way slowly underneath to cup my bottom. He sighed with contentment, squeezing slightly.
I kind of think when I have felt less triste, he said.
Me either,
I said, tracing the whorl of the small cowlick that lifted the hair from the centre of his forehead.
That's what made me think of it. I rather wondered what led the ancient philosopher to that conclusion.
I suppose it depends on the sorts of animalii he'd been fornicating with,
Jamie observed.
Maybe it was just that none of them took to him, but he must have tried a fair number to make such a sweeping statement.
He held tighter to his anchor as the tide of my laughter bounced him gently up and down.
Mind ye, dogs sometimes do look a trifle sheepish when they've done wee meeting, he said.
And how do sheep look then?
Aye, well, female sheep just go on looking like sheep, not having a great deal of choice in the matter, ye ken.
Oh, and what do male sheep look like?
Oh, they look fair depraved. Let their tongues hang out, drooling, and their eyes roll back while they make disgusting noises. Like most male animals, aye?
I could feel the curve of his grin against my shoulder. He squeezed again, and I pulled gently on the ear closest to hand.
I didn't notice your tongue hanging out.
You weren't noticing. Your eyes were closed.
I didn't hear any disgusting noises, either.
Well, I couldn't just think of any on the spur of the moment, he admitted. Perhaps I'll do better next time.
We laughed softly together, and then were quiet, listening to each other breathe. Jamie, I said softly at last, smoothing the back of his head, I don't think I've ever been so happy. He rolled to one side, shifting his weight carefully so as not to squash me, and lifted himself to lie face to face with me.
Nor me, my Sassenach,
he said, and kissed me very lightly, but lingering, so that I had time just to close my lips in a tiny bite on the fullness of his lower lip.
"It's no just the bedding, ye ken," he said,
drawing back a little at last. His eyes looked down at me, a soft, deep blue like the warm tropic sea.
"No," I said, touching his cheek, "it isn't."
"To have you with me again, to talk with you, to know I can say anything, not guard my words or hide my thoughts. God, Sassenach," he said, "the Lord knows I am lust-crazed as a lad, and I can't keep my hands from you, or anything else," he added wryly. "But I would count that all well lost, had I no more than the pleasure of having you by me, and to tell you all my heart."
"It was lonely without you," I whispered. "So lonely."
"And me," he said.
He looked down, long lashes hiding his eyes, and hesitated for a moment.
"I willna say I've lived a monk," he said quietly. "When I had to, when I felt that I must or go mad."
I laid my fingers against his lips to stop him.
"Neither did I," I said. "Frank..."
His own hand pressed gently against my mouth. Both dumb, we looked at each other, and I could feel the smile growing behind my hand, and my own under his to match it.
I took my hand away.
"That doesn't signify," he said.
He took his hand off my mouth.
"No,"
I said, "it doesn't matter." I traced the line of his lips with my finger.
"So, tell me all your heart," I said, "if there's time."
He glanced at the window to gauge the light. We were to meet Ian at the print shop at 5 o'clock, to check the progress of the search for young Ian, and then rolled carefully off me.
"There's 2 hours at least before we must go. Sit up and put your clothes on, and I'll have them bring some wine and biscuits."
This sounded wonderful. I seemed to have been starving ever since I found him. I sat up and began to rummage through the pile of discarded clothes on the floor, looking for the set of stays the low-necked gown required.
"I'm no ways sad, but I do maybe feel a bit ashamed," Jamie observed, wriggling long slender toes into a silk stocking. "Or I should, at least."
"Why is that?"
"Well, here I am in paradise, so to speak, with you and wine and biscuits, while Ian's out tramping the pavements and worrying for his son."
"Are you worried about young Ian?" I asked, concentrating on my laces. He frowned slightly, pulling on the other stocking.
"Not so much worried for him, as afraid he may not turn up before tomorrow."
"What happens tomorrow?" I asked, and then belatedly recalled the encounter with Sir Percival Turner.
"Oh, your trip to the north. That was supposed to be tomorrow?"
He nodded.
"Aye. There's a rendezvous set at Mullins Cove tomorrow, being the dark of the moon. A lugger from France with a load of wine and cambric."
"And Sir Percival was warning you not to make that rendezvous?"
"So it seems. What's happened, I canna say, though I expect I'll find out. Could be as there's a visiting customs officer in the district, or he's had word of some activity on the coast there that has nothing to do with us, but could interfere."
He shrugged and finished his last garter. He spread out his hands upon his knees then, palm up, and slowly curled the fingers inward. The left curled at once into a fist, compact and neat, a blunt instrument ready for battle. The fingers of his right hand curled more slowly. The middle finger was crooked and wouldn't lie along the second. The fourth finger wouldn't curl at all, but stuck out straight, holding the little finger at an awkward angle beside it. He looked from his hands to me, smiling.
"Do you remember the night when you set my hand?"
"Sometimes, in my more horrible moments."
That night was one to remember, only because it couldn't be forgotten.
Against all odds, I had rescued him from Wentworth Prison and a death sentence, but not in time to prevent his being cruelly tortured and abused by Black Jack Randall. I picked up his right hand and transferred it to my own knee. He let it lie there, warm, heavy and inert, and didn't object as I felt each finger, pulling gently to stretch the tendons and twisting to see the range of motion in the joints.
"My first orthopaedic surgery, that was," I said wryly.
"Have you done a great many things like that since?" he asked curiously, looking down at me.
"Yes, a few. I'm a surgeon, but it doesn't mean then what it means now," I added hastily. "Surgeons in my time don't pull teeth and let blood. They're more like what's meant now by the word physician. A doctor with training in all the fields of medicine, but with a speciality."
"Special, are you? Well, you've always been that," he said, grinning.
The crippled fingers slid into my palm, and his thumb stroked my knuckles.
"What is it that a surgeon does that's special, then?"
I frowned, trying to think of the right phrasing.
"Well, as best as I can put it,
a surgeon tries to effect healing by means of a knife." His long mouth curled upward at the notion.
"A nice contradiction, that, but it suits you, Sassenach."
"It does," I said, startled. He nodded, never taking his eyes off my face. I could see him studying me closely and wondered self-consciously what I must look like, flushed from lovemaking, with my hair in wild disorder.
"You haven't been lovelier, Sassenach," he said,
smile growing wider as I reached up to smooth my hair. He caught my hand and kissed it gently.
Leave your curls be.
No, he said, holding my hands trapped while he looked me over.
No, a knife is very much what you are, now I think of it. A clever worked scabbard, and most gorgeous to see, Sassenach.
He traced the line of my lips with a finger, provoking a smile.
But tempered steel for a core. And a wicked sharp edge, I do think.
Wicked?
I said, surprised. Not heartless, I don't mean, he assured me.
His eyes rested on my face, intent and curious. A smile touched his lips.
No, never that. But you can be ruthless strong, Sassenach, when the need is on you.
I smiled, a little wryly.
I can, I said. I've seen that in you before, I.
His voice grew softer, and his grasp on my hand tightened.
But now I think you have it much more than when you were younger. You'll have needed it often since, no?
I realised quite suddenly why he saw so clearly what Frank had never seen at all.
You have it too, I said.
And you've needed it, often. Unconsciously, my fingers touched the jagged scar that crossed his middle finger, twisting the distal joints. He nodded.
I have wondered, he said,
so low I could scarcely hear him.
Wondered often if I could call that edge to my service and sheathe it safe again. For I've seen a great many men grow hard in that calling and their steel decay to dull iron. And I have wondered often, was I master in my soul, or did I become the slave of my own blade? I have thought again and again, he went on, looking down at our linked hands, that I had drawn my blade too often, and spent so long in the service of strife that I wasna fit any longer for human intercourse.
My lips twitched with the urge to make a remark, but I bit them instead. He saw it and smiled, a little wryly.
I didna think I should ever laugh again in a woman's bed, Sassenach, he said, or even come to a woman, save as a brute blind with need.
A note of bitterness came into his voice. I lifted his hand and kissed the small scar on the back of it.
I can't see you as a brute, I said.
I meant it lightly, but his face softened as he looked at me, and he answered seriously.
I know that, Sassenach. And it is that you canna see me so that gives me hope. For I am, and know it, and yet perhaps...
He trailed off, watching me intently.
You have that, the strength. You have it, and your soul as well. So perhaps my own may be saved.
I had no notion what to say to this, and said nothing for a while, but only held his hand, caressing the twisted fingers and the large, hard knuckles. It was a warrior's hand, but he wasn't a warrior now. I turned the hand over and smoothed it on my knee, palm up. Slowly I traced the deep lines and rising hillocks and the tiny letter C at the base of his thumb, the brand that marked him mine. I knew an old lady in the Highlands once who said the lines in your hand don't predict your life, they reflect it.
Is that so then?
His fingers twitched slightly, but his palm lay still and open.
I don't know. She said you're born with the lines of your hand, with a life, but then the lines change with the things you do and the person you are.
I knew nothing about palmistry, but I could see one deep line that ran from wrist to mid-palm, forking several times. I think that might be the one they call a lifeline, I said. See all the forks? I suppose that would mean you'd changed your life a lot, made a lot of choices. He snorted briefly, but with amusement rather than derision.
Why? Well, that's safe enough to say.
He peered into his palm, leaning over my knee.
I suppose the first fork would be when I met Jack Randall, and the second when I wed you. See, they're close together there.
So they are. I ran my finger slowly along the line, making his fingers twitch slightly as it tickled. And Culloden, maybe, would be another.
Perhaps.
But he didn't wish to speak of Culloden. His own finger moved on.
And when I went to prison, and came back again, and came to Edinburgh.
And became a printer. I stopped and looked up at him, brows raised.
How on earth did you come to be a printer? It's the last thing I would have thought of.
Oh, that.
His mouth widened in a smile.
Well, it was an accident, eh?
To start with, he'd only been looking for a business that would help to conceal and facilitate the smuggling. Possessed of a sizeable sum from a recent profitable venture, he had determined to purchase a business whose normal operations involved a large wagon and team of horses, and some discreet premises that could be used for the temporary storage of goods in transit. Carting suggested itself, but was rejected precisely because the operations of that business made its practitioners subject to more or less constant scrutiny from the customs. Likewise, the ownership of a tavern or inn, while superficially desirable because of the large quantities of supplies brought in, was too vulnerable in its legitimate operation to hide an illegitimate one. Tax collectors and customs agents hung about taverns like fleas on a fat dog.
I thought of printing when I went to a place to have some notices made up, he explained. As I was waiting to put in my order, I saw the wagon come rumbling up, all loaded with boxes of paper and casks of alcohol for the ink powder. And I thought, by God, that's it. For excisemen would never be troubling a place like that.
It was only after purchasing the shop in Carfax Close, hiring Geordie to run the press, and actually beginning to fill orders for posters, pamphlets, folios and books, that the other possibilities of his new business had occurred to him.
It was a man named Tom Gage, he explained.
He loosed his hand from my grasp, growing eager in the telling, gesturing and rubbing his hands through his hair as he talked, dishevelling himself with enthusiasm.
He brought in small orders for this or that. Innocent stuff, all of it. But often, and stayed to talk over it, taking trouble to talk to me as well as to Geordie, though he must have seen I knew less about the business than he did himself.
He smiled at me wryly.
I didn't ken much about printing, Sassenach, but I do ken men.
It was obvious that Gage was exploring the sympathies of Alexander Malcolm. Hearing the faint sibilance of Jamie's Highland speech, he had prodded delicately, mentioning this acquaintance and that, whose Jacobite sympathies had led them into trouble after the Rising, picking up the threads of mutual acquaintance, skilfully directing the conversation, stalking his prey. Until at last, the amused prey had bluntly told him to bring what he wanted made. No king's man would hear of it.
And he trusted you?
It wasn't a question. The only man who had ever trusted Jamie Fraser in error was Charles Stewart. And in that case, the error was Jamie's.
He did.
And so an association was begun, strictly business in the beginning, but deepening into friendship as time went on. Jamie had printed all the materials generated by Gage's small group of radical political writers, from publicly acknowledged articles to anonymous broadsheets and pamphlets, filled with material incriminating enough to get the authors summarily jailed or hanged.
We'd go to the tavern down the street and talk, after the printing was done. I met a few of Tom's friends, and finally Tom said I should write a small piece myself. I laughed, and told him that with my hand, by the time I'd penned anything that could be read, we'd all be dead, of old age, not hanging. I was standing by the press as we were talking, setting the type with my left hand, not even thinking. He just stared at me, and then he started to laugh. He pointed at the tree and at my hand and went on laughing till he had to sit down on the floor to stop.
He stretched out his arms in front of him, flexing his hands and studying them dispassionately. He curled one hand into a fist and bent it slowly up toward his face, making the muscles of his arm ripple and swell under the linen.
"I'm hale enough," he said, "and with luck, maybe so for a good many years yet. But not forever, Sassenach. I have fought with sword and dirk many times, but to every warrior comes the day when his strength will fail him."
He shook his head and stretched out a hand toward his coat which lay on the floor.
"I took these that day with Tom Gage to remind me of it," he said.
He took my hand and put into it the things he had taken from his pocket. They were cool and hard to the touch, small heavy oblongs of lead. I didn't need to feel the inside ends to know what the letters on the type slugs were.
"QED," I said. "The English took my sword and dirk away," he said softly.
His finger touched the slugs that lay in my palm.
"But Tom Gage put a weapon into my hands again, and I think I shall not lay it down."
We walked arm in arm down the cobbled slope of the Royal Mile at 4:45, suffused with a glow engendered by several bowls of well-peppered oyster stew and a bottle of wine shared at intervals during our private communications. The city glowed all around us as though sharing our happiness. Edinburgh lay under a haze that would soon thicken to rain again, but for now the light of the setting sun hung gold and pink and red in the clouds and shone in the wet patina of the cobbled street so that the grey stones of the buildings softened and streamed with reflected light, echoing the glow that warmed my cheeks and shone in Jamie's eyes when he looked at me. Drifting down the street in this state of soft-headed self-absorption, it was several minutes before I noticed anything amiss. A man, impatient of our meandering progress, stepped briskly around us and then came to a dead stop just in front of me, making me trip on the wet stones and throw a shoe. He flung up his head and stared skyward for a moment, then hurried off down the street, not running, but walking as fast as he could go. "What's the matter with him?" I said, stooping to retrieve my shoe. Suddenly I noticed that all around us folk were stopping, staring up, and then starting to rush down the street. "What do you think?" I began. But when I turned to Jamie, he too was staring intently upward. I looked up too, and it took only a moment to see that the red glow in the clouds above was a good deal deeper than the general colour of the sunset sky, and seemed to flicker in an uneasy fashion most uncharacteristic of sunsets.
"Fire!" he said. "God, I think it's in Leith Wynd!"
At the same moment, someone farther down the street raised the cry of "Fire!" and as though this official diagnosis had given them leave to run at last, the hurrying figures below broke loose and cascaded down the street like a herd of lemmings anxious to fling themselves into the pyre. A few saner souls ran upwards past us, also shouting, "Fire!" but presumably with the intent of alerting whatever passed for a fire department. Jamie was already in motion, tugging me along as I hopped awkwardly on one foot. Rather than stop, I kicked the other shoe off and followed him, slipping and stubbing my toes on the cold, wet cobbles as I ran. The fire was not in Leith Wynd, but next door, in Carfax Close. The mouth of the close was choked with excited onlookers, shoving and craning in an effort to see, shouting incoherent questions at one another. The smell of smoke struck hot and pungent through the damp evening air, and waves of crackling heat beat against my face as I ducked into the close. Jamie didn't hesitate, but plunged into the crowd, making a path by main force. I pressed close behind him before the human waves could close again, and elbowed my way through, unable to see anything but Jamie's broad back ahead of me. Then we popped out in the front of the crowd, and I could see all too well. Dense clouds of grey smoke rolled out of both the print shop's lower windows, and I could hear a whispering, crackling noise that rose above the noise of the spectators, as though the fire were talking to itself.
My press!
With a cry of anguish, Jamie darted up the front step and kicked in the door. A cloud of smoke rolled out of the open doorway and engulfed him like a hungry beast. I caught a brief glimpse of him staggering from the impact of the smoke. Then he dropped to his knees and crawled into the building. Inspired by this example, several men from the crowd ran up the steps of the print shop and likewise disappeared into the smoke-filled interior. The heat was so intense that I felt my skirts blow against my legs with the wind of it and wondered how the men could stand it there inside. A fresh outbreak of shouting in the crowd behind me announced the arrival of the town guard armed with buckets. Obviously accustomed to this task, the men flung off their wine-red uniform coats and began at once to attack the fire, smashing the windows and flinging pails of water through them with fierce abandon. Meanwhile, the crowd swelled, its noise augmented by a constant cascade of pattering feet down the many staircases of the close, as families on the upper floors of the surrounding buildings hastily ushered hordes of excited children down to safety. I couldn't think that the efforts of the bucket brigade, valiant as they were, would have much effect on what was obviously a fire well underway. I was edging back and forth on the pavement, trying vainly to see anything moving within, when the lead man in the bucket line uttered a startled cry and leapt back, just in time to avoid being crowned by a tray of lead type that whizzed through the broken window and landed on the cobbles with a crash, scattering slugs in all directions. Two or three urchins wriggled through the crowd and snatched at the slugs, only to be cuffed and driven off by indignant neighbours. One plump lady in a kerch and apron darted forward, risking life and limb, and took custody of the heavy type tray, dragging it back to the curb, where she crouched protectively over it like a hen on a nest. Before her companions could scoop up the fallen type, though, they were driven back by a hail of objects that rained from both windows. More type trays, roller bars, inking pads and bottles of ink, which broke on the pavement, leaving big spidery blotches that ran into the puddles spilled by the firefighters. Encouraged by the draught from the open door and windows, the voice of the fire had grown from a whisper into a self-satisfied, chuckling roar. Prevented from flinging water through the windows by the rain of objects being thrown out of them, the leader of the town guard shouted to his men, and holding a soaked handkerchief over his nose, ducked and ran into the building, followed by a half-dozen of his fellows. The line quickly reformed, full buckets coming hand to hand round the corner from the nearest pump and up the stoop, excited lads snatching the empty buckets that bounced down the step to race back with them to the pump for refilling. Edinburgh is a stone city, but with so many buildings crammed cheek by jowl, all equipped with multiple hearths and chimneys, fire must be still a frequent occurrence. Evidently so, for a fresh commotion behind me betokened the belated arrival of the fire engine. The waves of people parted like the Red Sea to allow passage of the engine, drawn by a team of men rather than horses, which couldn't have negotiated the tight quarters of the wynds. The engine was a marvel of brass, glowing like a coal itself in the reflected flames. The heat was becoming more intense. I could feel my lungs dry and labour with each gulp of hot air and was terrified for Jamie. How long could he breathe in that hellish fog of smoke and heat, let alone the danger of the flames themselves?
Jesus, Mary and Joseph!
Ian, forcing his way through the crowd despite his wooden leg, had appeared suddenly by my elbow. He grabbed my arm to keep his balance as another rain of objects forced the people around us back again.
"Where's Jamie?" he shouted in my ear. "In there!"
I bellowed back, pointing. There was a sudden bustle and commotion at the door of the print shop, with a confused shouting that rose even over the sound of the fire. Several sets of legs appeared, shuffling to and fro beneath the emergent plume of smoke that billowed from the door. Six men emerged, Jamie among them, staggering under the weight of a huge piece of bulky machinery, Jamie's precious printing press. They eased it down the step and pushed it well into the crowd, then turned back to the print shop. too late for any more rescue manoeuvres. There was a crash from inside, a fresh blast of heat that sent the crowd scuttling backward, and suddenly the windows of the upper story were lit with dancing flames inside. A small stream of men issued from the building, coughing and choking, some of them crawling, blackened with soot and dampened with the sweat of their efforts. The engine crew pumped madly, but the thick stream of water from their hose made not the slightest impression on the fire. Ian's hand clamped down on my arm like the jaws of a trap.
"Ian!"
he shrieked, loud enough to be heard above the noises of crowd and fire alike. I looked up in the direction of his gaze and saw a wraith-like shape at the second-story window. It seemed to struggle briefly with the sash, and then to fall back or be enveloped in the smoke. My heart leapt into my mouth. There was no telling whether the shape was indeed young Ian, but it was certainly a human form. Ian had lost no time in gaping, but was stumping toward the door of the print shop with all the speed his leg would allow. "Wait!" I shouted, running after him. Jamie was leaning on the printing press, chest heaving as he tried to catch his breath and thank his assistants at the same time. "Jamie!" I snatched at his sleeve, ruthlessly jerking him away from a red-faced barber who kept excitedly wiping sooty hands on his apron, leaving long black streaks among the smears of dried soap and the spots of blood. "Up there!" I shouted, pointing. "Young Ian's upstairs!" Jamie stepped back, swiping a sleeve across his blackened face, and stared wildly at the upper windows. Nothing was to be seen but the roiling shimmer of the fire against the panes. Ian was struggling in the hands of several neighbours who sought to prevent his entering the shop. "No man, you canna go in," the guard captain cried, trying to grasp Ian's flailing hands. "The staircase has fallen and the roof will go next." Despite his stringy build and the handicap of his leg, Ian was tall and vigorous, and the feeble grasp of his well-meaning town guard captors, mostly retired pensioners from the Highland regiments, was no match for his mountain-hardened strength, reinforced as it was by parental desperation. Slowly but surely the whole confused mass jerked by inches up the steps of the print shop as Ian dragged his would-be rescuers with him toward the flames. I felt Jamie draw breath, gulping air as deep as he could with his seared lungs, and then he was up the steps as well, and had Ian round the waist, dragging him back.
"Come down, man," he shouted hoarsely. "You'll no manage. The stair is gone."
He glanced round, saw me, and thrust Ian bodily backward, off balance, and staggering into my arms.
"Hold him," he shouted over the roar of the flames. "I'll fetch down the lad."
With that, he turned and dashed up the steps of the adjoining building, pushing his way through the patrons of the ground-floor chocolate shop, who had emerged onto the pavement to gawk at the excitement, pewter cups still clutched in their hands. Following Jamie's example, I locked my arms tight around Ian's waist and didn't let go. He made an abortive attempt to follow Jamie, but then stopped and stood rigid in my arms, his heart beating wildly just under my cheek.
"Don't worry," I said pointlessly. "He'll do it. He'll get him out. He will. I know he will."
Ian didn't answer, might not have heard, but stood still and stiff as a statue in my grasp, breath coming harshly with a sound like a sob. When I released my hold on his waist, he didn't move or turn, but when I stood beside him, he snatched my hand and held it hard. My bones would have ground together had I not been squeezing back just as hard. It was no more than a minute before the window above the chocolate shop opened, and Jamie's head and shoulders appeared, red hair glowing like a stray tongue of flame escaped from the main fire. He climbed out onto the sill and cautiously turned, squatting, until he faced the building. Rising to his stockinged feet, he grasped the gutter of the roof overhead and pulled, slowly raising himself by the strength of his arms, long toes scrabbling for a grip in the crevices between the mortared stones of the house front. With a grunt audible even over the sound of fire and crowd, he eeled over the edge of the roof and disappeared behind the gable. a shorter man couldn't have managed.
Neither could Ian with his wooden leg.
I heard Ian say something under his breath. A prayer, I thought. But when I glanced at him,